accession number 28359, reel 4.
Fighters coming at you from all directions. And then, of course, you have to learn to be what they, you sort of have a gun commando. This, when you've got into operations, one bloke would be direct the firing so that all your firing was being used to good effect. So if a fighter was coming in, and he did the mistake for the sake of coming in from the rear, if you're flying in formation, all the guns could be directed at him, so he's not just combating with one. There wasn't a lot of chance against fighters, but there was a lot more chance than they show you on the film. They show you the fighters coming in and rat-a-tat-a-tat-a-tat, and that's it, the bomber goes down. But they're usually German bombers on the films. But yeah, there were a lot of techniques that were in, could be used to. And we in the Far East, with these power-operated turrets, we shot down a hell of a lot of jet fighters.
So when you start this training phase and you're in formation and the fighter comes, how do you communicate between tags? Is it somebody actually on the radio that you can hear in an ear set?
Well, you had some very basic radio telephony, which by voice, which you could use on this set. It wasn't terribly effective, not on those particular aircraft, but it was training purposes. On the more advanced aircraft we had later on, you could actually, the radio telephony, you didn't use the Morse code, strangely enough. Everything was RT, we called RT, which was voice over. So, yes, it was very efficient. Then the gunnery leader could give very clear, concise directions. In the days when we were training, it was a bit hit or miss.
Right.
And again, with the Swordfish, none of the sort of refinements we had later on, there was no interrupter gear. So if you weren't careful, you'd shoot off your own tail. It could be quite unpleasant too.
So as you swung the barrel of the gun around, bullets could
get overexcited, especially in action. If you're in action, you're just following the one round, you're firing away, then there's straight across your tail, which wasn't particularly funny. Not when you saw your tail dropping off.
Right.
Grab your parachute and hope for the best.
So you have your gunnery training, which started, you said, on rifles, so did they start you on a lead?
Well, they started getting familiarisation with... It was just part of familiarisation with weapon training rig. Just getting you used to guns, you know, and the guns that were available. I mean, at that time, or just before that time, the fleet arm was so obsolete that in the Fairey Formers, the air gunner had a Tommy gun. That's all he had.
So it was,
and they were in the height of the Mediterranean battles with those... Well, they had front guns in the former, but all they had from the rear... In fact, some of the blokes used to carry toilet rolls. They found if they threw that out, it confused the enemy fighters. I'm not kidding. They did, yeah.
And this was a Fairey...
Fairey former. Which is the original fleet air arm fighter, or one of the original, one of the old ones. Again, later on, they had much more. They had Sea Fires and Sea Hurricanes and American Corsairs.
Roy Gibbs, Reel 4. Roy, so we've got the gunnery training, which is ongoing, the telegraphy, mm-hmm. you're mastering, the navigation you're mastering. Mm-hmm.
Semaphore, Aldis lamp.
Semaphore, Aldis.
Being able to strip down guns and put them together in the air, and similar with a radio set.
When you strip down the radio set, were there many component parts?
Depends on how far you had to take it apart.
You could, all right, there were various stages of...
If you had a fault, and then what they did, they put a fault on the radio anyway, and it's your job to identify that fault and correct it. Now, I think even common sense dictated that they didn't, in an open cockpit aircraft, they didn't make the fault so great that you'd have to take out valves and resistances and all that sort of thing, because they'd simply fly off into the air, you know. So I think common sense dictated they put the basic faults in that you might have to run into. The other work you learnt to handle on the ground.
And could you give me an example of a basic fault in a radio that you would try and fix while you were in the air?
Well, it could be a blown valve, it could be a coil that wasn't working properly.
Presumably some of these faults came about because of the weather conditions, because you were in an open cockpit.
Open cockpit. And
water, salts, things like that could get into the...
It was the same with the gunnery training. That particular gun, you had a pan of ammunition that you had to take and fit on top of the gun. People were losing when you changed pans quickly, they were losing the empty pans so often that they actually fined us 5 shillings per pan that you lost, which was not terribly amusing since you weren't earning a fortune.
And they were being lost because they were going over the side of the...
Take one off, put another on quickly, forget, put it down there, and woof, it's gone. I mean, the slipstream is enormously powerful, even in an aircraft like that, if you're only doing about 90 to 140 knots, it's still pretty fierce, the slipstream.
And you mentioned the machine guns were gas operated.
It was called the Vickers gas operated machine gun. It means that there was an actual gas chamber in it. I don't know. Don't ask me what was in it. I can't remember. But which used to keep it cool. The Lewis guns, which are their predecessors, were air cooled, and they just, in other words, it's a hope that the slipstream, the air coming over the aircraft, would keep the barrel cool while you were firing it. But the actual, it created this gas, as far as I can remember, which went back and gave the necessary propellant to push the next cartridge up into the breech to fire. But you're talking about something that goes...
What caliber of bullets were you firing?
They were 303s.
.303.
Yeah. Right.
So
virtually the same as your Lee Enfield rifle.
Got you. Right. So how long were you... At this stage of the training, how long did that last?
The gunnery was for about the last 5 or 6 weeks, I think.
But you were in Canada altogether for...
I made it about 6 to 8 months, I think, looking at my logbook.
And this took you up to... What was the date when you finished your training in Canada?
Tell you in a minute. Well, it looks like my last flight in Canada was the 23rd of March... 1940. Must be 44. Yes, so I went there in 43. Yeah, 44.
And during this time, even though you're right across the Atlantic in Canada, were you still very much aware of what was happening in the other parts of the war?
I'd like to say yes, but I don't think we were. So the training was very intense. Everybody wanted desperately to get through their final exams. And we had this little joke we used to play on boats. People were studying so hard. They used to talk in their sleep in the dormitory, and we found that if you went up and questioned a chap while he was asleep, talking in his sleep, he would actually answer you, and we used to play this joke on people. It was very stressful, you know. And when we weren't actually doing that, we were having such a good time in the Canadian environment of, yachting on the big lake that was nearby, Lake Milo. When it froze over, we had ice skating on the lake, ice yachting, dancing with the girls in a place called the Snackery and the sailing club. There was only one cinema in the town, but we used to... the girls, I mean, the friends of family entertainment, had 3 daughters, 4 daughters. But one was only 13, so... another one was 15, I think, and one was about 21, and the other one was about 24. They had quite a gap. But they felt... don't look at me. They did everything they could to make you feel you're in your own home. I say some of the blokes did go back and marry the girls there, but there wasn't a lot of courting. But it's a different type of, but they just enjoyed life with them. It was a Yeah, for a boy from North London, it was a totally different lifestyle. I mean, you could walk into, there's only one main cafe in the high street, there's only a one street high street, and there's one cafe, or restaurant, they used to call it a restaurant. But, I mean, you could go in and have steak and eggs if you wanted, while you've got the money to pay for it. I mean, I've heard people say since, oh, of course, Canada had rationing, but that, it's a sort of rationing that people back here would love to have had, you know.
Yes.
Occasionally you felt guilty about that, not too often, though. And we're still only 18.
Were you writing to your parents?
Yep, and very kindly, the Canadian mother used to call him, adopted me, used to write to my mother how I was getting on. They really gave you a family environment which you hadn't had even some time at home, you know. And yeah, I think, to be terribly honest, we were aware of the war, because especially with the Ventura squadron on the other side of the Drome, because they were getting knocked down from time to time. And again, see, we had our own losses of people, but it wasn't like the environment back here where you were listening to every news on the radio, and you say every home had a war map where they used to move the flags around and that. And of course, you had the bombing, so you were very well aware of it. I often said subsequently, really, we had a jolly good 9 months holiday, except for the stress of training, which was very heavy, even to young minds, you know.
So what happened at the end of...
Well, you were assessed, and you were told whether you'd passed or not passed. If you passed successfully, halfway through, we were made up to acting leading airmen, which is about the equivalent to a corporal. If you pass successfully, you'd be made up to a leading airman, so silly, senior corporal. If you failed, you went back to the UK for remustering. Unlike the RAF, who had these terrific ball parades, of wings parades, where they all marched up, had their wings pinned to their breasts and so on, it was typical Navy. You were told you'd passed, you went quietly down to a little enterprising tailor in the town, who found he could make wings. You bought a pair of wings and you sewed them on yourself. And that was it. Detailed back to Halifax, again on an even more uncomfortable fast trooper back, where you reported to Leon Solent, HMS Daedalus. Leon Solent was sort of the depot, well, that was a land base, it was described as a depot ship for the Fleet Air Arm, where all the air crews went through and were apportioned to the various squadrons. I think I got a week's leave after that, first, because it's the first time I'd been home for some time, well over a year.
And you went back on a similar sort of troop ship?
Yeah, it was similar. I think this one was the Empress or something. It was obviously that line had these fast ships that used to go backwards and forwards. Leon Solent Daedalus was always overflowing because of the continual flow of not only air crew but maintenance crew going through there. We were sort of pushed into what was called a hutted camp on the far side of the aerodrome, which suited us, as we could be nice and privately on our own, and there's a very convenient back door we could get out to the local pub when you weren't supposed to. So we had 7 days leave, and then when we came back, I was drafted, as they used to call it with us, you were drafted to somewhere, to an Albacore squadron in Arbroath in Scotland.
So your trip back from Canada, were you still treated as naval crew?
Not really. It was full of RAF air crew that had passed out their various functions, pilots, observers, navigators, air gunners. Now, I think they used to train the air gunners at home. They didn't have the intensive training we had. But it was full of air crew. Everybody was NCOs, so you had to look after yourselves. It was, again, we were probably more used to it because we did know about messing. It only took about 5 days again. The only uncomfortable thing was you couldn't get a shower or anything like that. You didn't get a chance to undress. You were pretty grubby by the time you got back to UK. I said, yeah, that was it. We're ready to be drafted off. I said, I got drafted to this, I forget the number of the squadron now, but there's a squadron in an albacore squadron.
Albacore.
Albacore, which was a swordfish, the later version of the swordfish, but with a canvas hood, so you weren't completely open. It had sort of canvas and plastic type cover. Fairly boring. You know, we were doing patrols.
Where was this squadron?
Arbroath in Scotland.
Arbroath in Scotland.
We're doing patrols over the sea looking for enemy subs and so on.
Over the western side?
Yeah.
Looking for U-boats, German submarines.
And in between, we were seconded to... they'd got an observer's training school there, navigator observer. We called observers, and I think the fleet called them observers, and RAF called them navigators. So we were training them as well in the use of Morse and the use of radio.
So you were in the training role now, you were actually teaching?
Well, no, we were also doing patrols in this swordfish squadron, which really looking for enemy ships, enemy submarines. We thought, well, if this is the war, again, Arbroath was secluded.
Long way from the war.
Yeah. We had one odd incident when somebody said, "I never see these German aircraft anywhere around here." And then at that moment, a Ju-88 came whistling over the airdrop and dropped a load of bombs on the runway.
You
suddenly realise the war is not so far away. And then I think after about 2 months of that, I got another drafting to go to Inskip in Lancashire to join Grumman Avenger Squadron, which was my heyday, because we knew the Grumman Avenger, the American aircraft, these were first frontline aircraft, yeah, fantastic. Reported.
Just going back to Scotland, when you go on these patrols in the converted swordfish, what sort of range are you talking about out over the sea?
I suppose you'd go out for about 3 to 4 hours, which they give you about 400 miles, I suppose, if you. In total,
so
something like that.
Flying over
between 200 and 400 miles
over an endless expanse of
water. Just really probing out from the coast, looking for enemy submarines or enemy aircraft, and hoping you wouldn't find one because you wouldn't. I mean, they were individual patrols, so you're on your own. You had no, just had the power of your own gun.
Did you find that the navigation training you'd had put you in good stead for these flights?
Yeah, it was useful, but quite often when we did these patrols, they put a trainee observer in with us anyway, so they could get some practice. Often you were answering questions to them as well, or asking them questions, free exchange of information.
So after that, down to Yorkshire?
Down to Yorkshire, Lancashire. When I got there, I was quite amazed. The difference between the fleet and the RAF used to move their blokes in bulk, a whole squadron would move. The fleet air, they tell you you're on trust to go on your own. You packed your own, packed your bags, and off you went. I got down to this Avenger squadron, knew nothing about me, and didn't want to know anything about me. So, no, you're not supposed to inquire, you're not supposed to be here. Oh, they did inquire, and they found that I should have been on the Isle of Man on a Barracuda squadron. So I got my travel warrants and that, and off I went to the Isle of Man and reported to this aerodrome. It was called HMS. All the fleet hour bases had HMSs, even though they're over aerodromes. It's HMS Early. Wasn't very happy about the situation. The Barracuda was a new fleet hour on dive bomber. Was made to be the answer to the Ju-87, the Stuka.
It was the British answer to the Stuka. Had
great big dive breaks. The only trouble was the Admiralty, in their wisdom, had decided, we can't just have a dive bomber. We need it to be a torpedo bomb as well, and they started putting torpedoes under it. As a result, it was underpowered, the engine. It could have been a marvellous aircraft if they'd let it perform the function it should have performed. And then the wings started dropping off, and it had the experimental squadrons, which we, as a fleet air of a small service, you hear what's going on in other squadrons.
Yes.
And one particular squadron in, I think it was in Crail in Scotland, had lost every Barracuda. Instead of pulling out the dive, they'd gone straight into the sea. and it got a terrible reputation. I thought, oh, I can do without joining this one. Anyway, I did, and there for the first time I met the guys I was going to be flying with for the next 18 months, 2 years. Then getting, so I was going to have my first operational, real operational crew before I'd flown with all and sundry, you know.
So Barracuda, how many crew does it take?
Three, pilot, observer, and telegraph stair gunner.
So this absolved you of the navigational side of the operation, is that correct?
To a degree, but the observer would just probably still ask you to get a direction finding bearing.
Right.
And again, you never knew whether you're going to lose your observer, so you had to keep up to scratch.
Right. And you mentioned air brakes. How does that work?
They're like huge flaps that came out in the wing. I haven't got a picture of a Barracuda on here, actually. Huge air brakes that came out in the wing, which allowed it to dive. They dive almost vertically.
I see.
So unfortunately, of course, they had this small trouble, like the wing started falling off.
Right.
They did find that they were trying to carry too much in it. The wing rivets were popping out, and they swore that they'd got it okay by the time I got to the squadron, but no one was particularly happy about it.
And so how did you find them when you actually flew in them?
I found them quite good. The equipment was still fairly obsolete. We still had this old Wurlitzer transmitter and these old, I think it was the R1112 receiver, which were still back to the old coils and taking.
And you nicknamed it Wurlitzer after the Wurlitzer organs.
Yeah,
presumably.
Because it's all these different coloured things you had to
like
plug in.
Yeah, stops on an organ.
You had to plug these coils in and out. They're all different colours. You're colour coded, bright colours. So we still had that. Slight improvement. We did have twin Vickers gas operated guns, so we had two guns firing aft, and it did have an interrupter gear. It had to, because it had a Barracuda, a great big high tail.
So as you swung the gun across the tail, it automatically stopped firing.
It threw the gun. The theory was it threw the gun up
and over.
And over. Didn't always work. That was the theory. Like so many things at one time, it didn't work. It's good and bad. I met my crew. We got it. My pilot was a Sergeant Royal Marines, Alan, and our observer was Frank, was a midshipman. Frank was obviously, again, going back to the social structure of things in those days. His father was an admiral, so we guessed he was really a midshipman. He was going to get fairly rapid promotion, which he did. He became a sub lieutenant very quickly. My pilot had quite a bit of experience. That he was sent for one day by the CO, who told him there is no such thing as a Sergeant Marine pilot. You are commissioned. Go and get a proper uniform. So we still laughed about this because he used to come and visit us here, and we used to go and visit them in Australia. He lives in Australia now. And we laughed about it. He said, I should have had to go through all this nonsense. He said, to get promotion. He said, they just gave it to me. And he actually told this lovely story when he was training in Canada. They'd never had a Marine on it, because he'd been an ordinary Marine, you know, fighting Marine. So when he got halfway through his pilot's course, they made all the other rating pilots, as they were called, petty officers. So they made him a corporal. And then when they passed out, they became chief petty officers, and they made him a sergeant. But this course, he was told he was commissioned. He says,
that must be commissioned as in he became an officer.
Yeah, commissioned as a sub lieutenant. But we had a very good relationship, and by then I'd become a petty officer, and we did everything together. We went ashore together, we drank together, we ate together, and I think we had about 3 months on this Isle of Man squadron, where again they used to mix. It was supposed to be you're also learning to live with your crew. But they always got value for money. We used to do patrols, and we were also working up as individual crews and learning about squadron working up and working as a squadron. I think the only bit of excitement we had during that time was we bombed a submarine, which unfortunately turned out to be one of our own that was off course. The captain of the submarine came to visit the sub, Quincy, and it cost us a lot of drinks to calm him down.
He he actually came to complain about this?
Well, he came to see, he brought back some anti-aircraft, sort of debris that had gone into his conning tower from the bomb.
Oh, some shrapnel.
Yes, shrapnel. Returned it to us, you know, with his compliments. It cost us a lot of drinks in the local pub. Apart from that, we were something new to us. We were doing masses of night flying. We were getting trained into night flying, so you were flying night after night. And we had about 3 months of this. And
So the patrols you were doing was the similar sort of thing you were doing earlier in Scotland.
Yeah, just going out
over the sea, looking
for enemy shipping and so on. We made a mistake one night of flying over Barrow and Furness, which would be about trying to fly over London when the people started shooting at us.
Because I think they probably...
We were off course, in other words. We shouldn't have been there.
There were naval dockyards there.
Yeah. And we were off course, we shouldn't have been there. Nothing didn't come to any harm, but it was rather scary. And at the end of this, we were deemed to be an efficient crew. And so, like, your next move, you'll be drafted to frontline squadron.
This aircraft, the Barracuda?
Yeah, Barracuda, yeah.
Describe it compared to the Swordfish. Presumably you have a closed cockpit?
Completely closed cockpits. Bit of heating in them, electrical heating. It could have been a fine aircraft, but...
What was the seating configuration?
Pilot facing forward, observer in the middle who could sit, forward or aft. So frontwards or backwards, and he had two big blisters in the side. He could look out sideways.
Sort of big blister windows. You could see outside.
And we had, the air gunners had a seat at the back where you could facing the rear all the time.
Right.
Although you could swing round and talk to him. Yeah. You know.
And it was the observer's task to look for shipping. And is he using binoculars?
Yeah. Well, it was all our task to look for any enemy shipping. Any enemy submarines, anything that would show hostile.
And did you find during this flight that because very little was turning up, were you starting to get blasé about it? Were you getting bored about it?
No, really. We were reflection. We were they were turning us into a three blokes into a single entity. We were learning to live together, work together, anticipate each other. All of this was very handy later on. And for some reason they decided we'd earn some leave, and they told us to go off on indefinite leave, and since we all lived in or around London, we had about 2 weeks of hijinks, and then we got a telegram, and they say the Navy worked this way, and a telegram, report to 820 Naval Air Squadron, Macrihanish in Scotland. So I phoned Alan, and we phoned Frank, and we'd all got... So we arranged to meet, I think, at Euston or somewhere, Euston Station, or one of them, might have been King's Cross. It became a bit difficult when we were travelling around, because as commissioned officers, they were entitled to first-class travel. As a petty officer, I was entitled to third-class travel. But we'd become so close that they gave up their first-class travel and came and sat with me in the third class. But we had a horrendous journey up to Scotland, long journey. Transport was bad during the war. Train... coach, boat, naval lorries. And guess what? When we got to Macrihanish, 820 Squadron, they took off yesterday, that Leon Solent.
They're at Leon Solent. So at the other
they'd flown down.
They're at the other end of the
So country. Back we went, coach, lorry, coach, boat, train, right down to Leon Solent, which was right down by Portsmouth, right in the south of England, and there was a squadron. And so typical of the wartime... mistakes they used to make. You never believe what had happened. The Barracuda squadron had just turned in all their Barracudas, so they were flying Grumman Avengers.
Right, so you are now...
So we're now, having done 3 months intensive training in Barracudas, belong to a Grumman Avenger squadron.
Right, Grumman Avenger. Now, the Grumman Avenger, before we go to that, your leave back in London, you hadn't been in London for a while since you were on the Daily Express before you were called up. Had conditions changed much in London by then?
I'm not sure whether... Yes, that's when I saw my first doodle bug. I was with my wife, actually. I said, what's that? And she dragged me into a doorway and pushed me on the floor. I'd heard about these things, but... Funny enough, again, in the Isle of Man, you were living sort of in your own war. Of course, the results of the bombing was terrible. Apart from Joan, who we were still sort of boy and girl courting, I suppose you'd call it in those days. All my friends were away anyway. So I used to tend to meet up with my crew, and we used to drink too much and smoke too much and go around the senior clubs that we knew, perhaps from our, I was going to say, my Fleet Street days. We just had a good time, you know. Joan, of course, was at work. I mean, Alan wasn't, none of the other two were married. Alan had a girlfriend, I think, but we had a bit of an uproarious time.
And your parents, how did you went and lived back with your parents? Yes?
Yeah, I came back to my parents' home, yeah.
What was their reaction? Their boy had gone away, he's been to Canada, now he's come back, he's a trained telegraph air gunner.
Obviously very pleased to see me. As usual, my mother cried, as I recall. Daddy insisted on taking me up the pub for drinks. Not really, I mean, they'd had such rough times themselves. You know, they told you about it. I don't think they wanted to worry you. And again, I suppose to a degree, we thought we were fighting our own war.
Mm-hmm.
People tended to be compartmentalised in those days. At least I found it so.
In the sense that they were in London, and what they were experiencing was very different to what you were experiencing in Ireland.
Oh, very much so. I mean, bombing day and night. The doodle bugs had started by then, which were these buzz bomb things, which automated sort of bombs. I think everybody was beginning to suffer from the nerves of these things, you know. I was just enthralled. I'd never seen one before. I say, really, it was a fortnight. We just determined to enjoy ourselves. We didn't know where we were going next.
Just one thing, Roy. Going back to, you mentioned night flying in the Barracudas. How different was that? Did you use anything in particular that was different, or were you still using the same navigational methods?
Just really just acclimatising yourself to flying at night from flying during the day. I mean, your body clock had to change a bit because you're suddenly awake from perhaps 10 o'clock around till 3 in the morning, whereas you would normally be sleeping. So again, we're all so young, I think you adjust very quickly.
But the aircraft and the systems you used wasn't any specific piece of equipment brought in for night flying, or
no particular equipment. No, your radio was very important, of course, because you could get direction finding bearings and so on the drone. So that your radio was of great importance at that particular time, or that flight. I never to this day could figure out why we had such intensive training in night flying, because subsequently, when we were in the Pacific, which we'll probably talk about later, we desperately needed a night flying carrier, and we hadn't got one. As we used to bomb the Japanese airfields by day, and they'd come out at night and mend them all. So the next morning we went back, and they'd all been mended. And we desperately needed a night flying carrier, but we just hadn't got one. So somewhere along the line, we didn't learn a lesson, you know.
You mean a ship that would allow night flying?
A carrier that would carry crews that were trained in night flying.
I see.
Squadrons that were trained in night flying.
It wasn't a specific ship, it was the squadrons that were trained.
Yeah, and it would probably be have the radio radio equipment and so on, the technology to land planes on in the dark and take off in the dark. Somebody in authority didn't learn a lesson. We just hadn't got one, and that was it. But why, in those early days, we were so high... They made a thing of it, they were so highly trained in night flying. But I never did any night flying from that time. To tell you, I was demobbed.